someone you should know and someone you should also follow on social media. On Twitter, she is at @HayShayY. She writes for us here at Sportsnet.ca, also for The Athletic as well. And she joins me on The Merrick Show. Shayna, how are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. And make sure that I ask you about scrunchies at some point, too, because I'll get carried away talking, I'll forget it, and I do have it written down. I want to get to some Ranger talk. They're playing the Boston Bruins coming up here at the top of the hour. We're going to be watching that one as we're still on the air, but we'll have it in the side of the room. An interesting piece you put together here at Sportsnet.ca, and, you know, we're a quarter of the way in, and we're all sort of doing our... Okay, let's take stock. Let's look under the hood. Teams know what they have. Teams know what they need. Sometimes our eyes can deceive us, as we all know. From your point of view, maybe we'll start with Anaheim, who you started with. Who are the surprises? Who are the disappointments? Let's start with, as you call them, the Young Ducks.
Yeah, so I think the thing with Anaheim is that no one really anticipated them to be the tough team to play that they, you know, that they've become this season. We all know that John Gibson is an incredible goaltender and he has had a couple rough years, but a great goalie doesn't become terrible overnight. You know, it's a volatile position, but, you know, at his core, he's still one of the best goalies in the league and he's showing that, but it's the young players leading the way. And it's impressive that they have enough scoring talent to distribute between two lines. And I think that's the key for them. So a player like Trevor Zegras can be thriving on the second line while Troy Terry is just pairing it up on line one with Ryan Getzlaf.
So Troy Terry is fascinating because, you know, a year ago, what was the story about Troy Terry? He's asked for a trade. He wants out. He's done here. And it's amazing what happened. Now, I don't know what the status of his trade request is right now. There's a new interim general manager, Bob Murray, who has, you know, had issues with a lot of different players over contract status and stay or go. He's no longer in the picture. So I'm not sure where Troy Terry's trade request is at. But one thing I am sure of, Shayna, he's not going to keep shooting around 30%. True or false?
True. That, you know, we know shooting percentages generally regress to the mean, and his career average at this point is around 12.5. So that's asking for a lot. But there's encouraging signs that he's going to keep scoring goals. And, you know, a lot of it's the fact that he's shooting the puck at a high rate and he's getting to the quality area. So when you keep doing that, there's a good chance that you'll continue scoring, just maybe not at the rate that he has thus far. And it helps that that Ryan Getzlaf's passing the puck a ton to him. But it's not that Terry's become too one-dimensional. You know, he's passing at a really high rate. He's getting those passes to the quality areas as well. So he has both in his arsenal, which might make him tougher to defend.
You know, I wonder about Troy. Like in Canada right now, one of the conversations is, can Andrew Mangiapane make the Canadian Olympic team? I mean, he's come out of the gate just, you know, firing on all cylinders, 15 goals, tied for second in the NHL. And, you know, I would imagine that amongst, you know, American hockey observers, maybe one of the questions there is, can Troy Terry make the American team? Like, we've seen him thrive internationally before, and the shot is amongst the elite. How much conversation is there around Troy Terry and the U.S. Olympic team?
I think there should be. I think the biggest problem the U.S. Olympic team has had is, you know, the roster is pretty predictable, and they could use that infusion of skill and youth. And I do wonder if maybe Trevor Zegras gets a longer look just given what he did at World Juniors. And that obviously has to come into consideration what they can do on the big stage and what they've done for Team USA before. But I think both of them should really be in the conversation because they could use someone who can score goals and they can use someone who could pass the puck. And, you know, in Zegras' case too, someone who can carry the puck into the zone at a high rate. You know, he's one of the best in the league at doing that. So if you can mix either one in, maybe Team USA gets a different look, and it helps them move past what they've done in recent years.
Yeah, what do you let's get a little further into Zegras here. So he was my pick for the Calder, and now we all know that Lucas Raymond is running away with it. Like, you can make the argument that the bet for Calder shouldn't be, you know, player versus player. It should be Raymond versus the field. Take one. That's how far Lucas Raymond is ahead of everybody else. But I picked Zegras and still expect him to be part of that conversation somewhere down the road. What does he, you know, you mentioned carrying the puck into the offensive zone. What's the main skill set that you marvel at for Trevor Zegras?
It's his passing. He's so creative and he's so deceptive with his passing, and he just does it so quickly. You know, he could be under pressure and he's still going to get off this skilled pass. But on the other hand, you really don't know if he's only going to pass the puck. I think everybody saw his passing on display at World Juniors the first time around. And the second time, we really saw his shooting and his passing. So with Anaheim, I think he jumped out passing a little bit more. And now we're seeing both his shot and his pass. But he can maintain possession, you know, while under pressure and just skate around the offensive zone if he needs to. And he can find his teammates with the perfect, you know, threaded pass. So I think that's the most exciting for me. But now seeing how he's taking off with his shot as well, you know, that dual threat ability, it's something to watch for every night.
And I like him doing his Jack Hughes tribute, throwing his stick into the crowd after scoring a goal. That's, I want to see more of that, Sheena, in the,
absolutely.
In the NHL. You know, yesterday, my producer Matt and I did our quarter part rankings here for the season. And we got to the Vezina, and I had a few. Like, ultimately, I ended up going with Igor Shesterkin, who I just think is, considering how the Rangers bleed chances and how Shesterkin continues to bail them out and they continue to succeed mainly because of him, I went with the Rangers netminder. But there were a couple in here that, you know, you've written about, and on your most recent piece at .ca, you write about as well. One of them is Freddie Anderson, and the other is Sergei Bobrovsky. Two bounce backs, Shayna.
Yeah. So, like I said before, a good goalie doesn't suddenly become a terrible goalie overnight. And we did kind of see that with Bobrovsky the last few seasons. He's been playing on a good team in Florida, but he just hasn't been playing up to expectations, especially in those most crucial moments, which is why he lost the starting net at the end of the playoffs. There was definitely pressure on him to step it up this year with Spencer Knight right there. You know, it's very clear. Versus Chris Drieger, you know, it was Spencer Knight is the future of this organization. With Drieger, they didn't have that same vision for him. So I think that does change things a bit. But he's still being protected pretty well. The Panthers don't allow too many quality chances. They don't allow too many shots against. But he's still playing well relative to his workload, and that's why he's saving so many more goals than expected. So if he can maintain it, you know, he definitely has a good chance at the Vezina. And the same goes for Anderson. He, again, is not playing behind the toughest of workloads. But this is a, you know, a player who's been declining over the last few seasons. This wasn't that his game suddenly flipped on its head and he was terrible. We've seen that progressively get worse. And it, you know, it's not like he was playing on a bad Maple Leafs team in recent years. You know, at the beginning, sure. But as they got stronger defensively, his game, you would expect to be better, and it wasn't. So now he has a very strong Hurricanes team in front of him, but he's complimenting them and is a reason why they've had such a strong start too. So either one could be in the Vezina conversation, but it does depend on how you look at the award too. Do you think it needs to be the best performing goaltender period, or is it the goaltender who's challenged the most and is carrying their team as well as playing as well as, you know, two of the better goalies like Bobrovsky and Anderson?
See, and that's why I went with Shesterkin. Because I went with Shesterkin because if you look at, you know, if you look at Georgiev, for example, I mean, his save percentage, his performance is, you know, well under what many consider acceptable goaltending standards for a team that's going to qualify for the playoffs, which tells me one thing. Shesterkin's been amazing. Shesterkin, like, will make huge stops. The Rangers give up tons of great looks, and they're fine with it as long as he's in it. It's still the same team in front of Georgiev. But he bleeds pucks. Maybe it is a reflection of the Rangers because they give up so many high danger chances on a consistent basis. And we'll probably see it again here in 15 minutes when they face off against the Boston Bruins. But Shesterkin makes those saves. And I know it's dangerous. I know it's dangerous to predicate your team on, we're going to give up a lot of high danger chances in our zone, but that's okay because we got a good goalie. Like, you're really playing with fire when you do that. But so far, and maybe we'll get a thought from you on the Rangers in general, you know, so far it's been fine because Shesterkin is that good. And as Kelly Rudy always tells me, you should never have to apologize for having a great goaltender on your team.
Yeah, no, they definitely shouldn't apologize for that, but it really is their identity. It's funny how much this team has changed and how much they haven't over, you know, the last decade. They can play loose defensively and force their goaltender to be the difference maker, and they had that for, you know, over 10 years in Henrik Lundqvist. they're very lucky that they're having that right now in Shesterkin. The interesting thing between the two goaltenders right now, though, is the Rangers are playing better when Georgiev's in net. Last year was a really good example of it, and obviously this team is different from where they were last year, but while he was out for a handful of games, it was Georgiev and Kincaid playing in net, and the Rangers played their best defensive hockey. Their goaltenders still struggled despite not having nearly the challenging workload that they generally would have. So this year, you're seeing it that they're bleeding chances from the slot. You know, as much as they're working to tighten up in the neutral zone, they're allowing chances against, and they're getting right to those quality areas. Shesterkin's making the stops, and Georgiev isn't. And it's such a tricky thing to live by, because if he has a bad game, which earlier this season we saw very few bad games, but if he wasn't perfect, the team wasn't winning because he couldn't steal that game. Now the team's starting to play a little bit better in front of them, but you can still see one goaltender, you know, outperforming the other one by a mile.
So right now, sticking with the Rangers, I mean, they're in third place. And I can remember that first game of the season we all watched expecting fireworks because it's the Rangers and the Capitals. And the Rangers had, you know, gone out in the off season and loaded up on nuclear deterrence. And it was a game where the Washington Capitals did whatever they wanted all game long. And we said, uh-oh, maybe the Rangers haven't improved as much as we thought they have yet. Here we go, 19 games in, game 20 this afternoon against the Bruins. They're 12-4-3, 27 points, playing at a 7-11 clip right now, and they've won, they're on a two-game little mini winning streak right now. It seems like everybody outside of the Islanders, and they're their own separate story, has improved to some degree. I know Flyers fans don't feel that way, but Columbus has. Pittsburgh still hangs in there. They're still trying to outwork teams every night, and they've won four in a row. New Jersey's improved. Are the Rangers, when you look at the field that they're competing against, really a third-place team in the Metro, or did they just happen to be there right now?
I think in ways they happen to be there right now, which is a little bit harsh because, you know, it's important to earn the points even when you're not playing at your best. So then, you know, you're not at a disadvantage from the get-go, which they were the last couple of seasons. And then at the end, they're racing to get those points and just falling short. This is a totally different position for them to be in, but there's so many ways this team can still improve. And a lot of it does stem from their offense. They were in a better position to succeed in the sense that they went with a coaching change in the offseason because they needed a change of pace. They needed different offensive strategies. So right there, they were helping out their team, and they were opening up bigger roles for younger players to step up. But they did hinder their chances with some of their offseason moves because it was reactionary to toughen up and get those types of players when they still need skill. You know, at the end of the day, you still need skill up and down your lineup. And we are seeing at times that lack of skill in the lineup shining when their top players aren't at their best, or when a player like Barkley Gaudreau is playing on the first line, which really didn't work. It seems like now that Artemi Panarin's playing his best hockey, because he wasn't to start the season, and Ryan Strome's found his footing too, and Kaapo Kakko's breaking out like we expected him to, that the team is finding their footing. So the points that they earned earlier in the season are helping them, but moving forward, if they can keep building, they can legitimately look like that third-place team that they are right now. But I still think that there's a little ways for them to go to truly earn, you know, their current standing. And maybe it's because I watch them day-to-day so much that I am as harsh as I am on them, but there's definite holes in the lineup that show at points.
I'll tell you what, though, and it might be forest for the trees for someone that covers them all season long as closely as you do. It is, I've always maintained this, it's a better league when the Rangers are playing well. When the Rangers are an elite-level team, it's better for everybody in the NHL. I know Islanders fans don't want to hear that. I know that Devils fans don't want to hear that. I get all that, but trust me, it really is, as I think people understand. Hey, and getting back to netminding, and Allison Lucan, who does color work with the Seattle Kraken, knows this all too well and has done a lot of work on this, and you've worked plenty with Allison as well, mainly on the podcast. Thoughts on the goaltending in Seattle? Like, I look at this expansion team and I say, I kind of think they're okay, but their goaltending really isn't, and that is dragging them down. How do you see the Kraken netminding?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Their defensive play actually is, you know, relatively strong in the league. According to HockeyViz, I think it's 16% stronger in terms of their expected goal rate than league average, but they're not getting those saves. And the big thing, and I heard Allison stress this a bunch on the broadcast, it's key saves at key times, and they're not getting those. And a lot of those key times are odd man rushes against. Does the defense need to work on those too? Absolutely. And they have the last two games against the Capitals and against the Hurricanes. But the biggest thing is that their goaltender is the last line of defense, and he isn't playing well when he's facing those odd man rushes. But something interesting about Grubauer is, if we look back at his time acclimating to a new team or a new role, so Washington, then Colorado, and now Seattle, he has gotten off to rough starts before he's found his footing. So it'll be interesting to see if that's the case here too. If the beginning is kind of erratic and then we see him stabilize and become the goaltender we expect him to be. But it's not that he's someone that's not used to playing behind a strong defensive team either. You know, in Colorado, he was playing behind one of the best two-way teams. So now he has a strong defensive team. Maybe he doesn't have that same offensive support. And given their roster, maybe he never will, you know, this season. But I think that Seattle, especially if they get better offensively, we'll see the whole team start trending in the right direction. But it does come down to him, you know, improving, and maybe the last two games are an indication that he's on the right path now.
Before I let you go, I promised I would do this, and I want to. Hockey-themed scrunchies. You're the master. Give yourself a plug and describe these for people that may be unaware. And by the way, you can follow Shayna at Hey, H-A-Y-Y-Y, Shay, S-H-A-Y-Y-Y on Twitter.
So, you know, they're just a cute accessory. I think sometimes hockey merch for women is pointed in the wrong direction. You know, it'll be pink and sparkly or something like that when, you know, we just want things fitted for us that happen to, you know, have team insignia on it. But the scrunchies, I honestly just had a ton of extra fabric from the masks, so I started experimenting to make them. I never did that before, and I figured, why not? I always wear big scrunchies, and, you know, it is a little bit of a 90s vibe unless you go for the super small size, but yeah, they come in three different sizes. So depending on your hair type or what your style is, you can get a scrunchie for your favorite team in cotton or flannel for the NHL. And then there's a handful of other fabrics available too.
What's your Etsy shop? What's the address?
It's Etsy.com/shop/Hey Shay with three Y's on the Hey and three Y's on the Shay, just like my Twitter handle.
And now as far as teams go, what seems to be the big mover? And I'm guessing it's going to be Seattle because that's selling out everywhere, but is it for you too?
Yeah, Seattle was definitely high. A lot of Rangers scrunchies, which makes sense given that people who follow me on Twitter definitely follow the Rangers. Gritty is a big seller. Everybody loves Gritty. Yeah, that's nice. It's a fun one. And the North Stars and Whalers do really well.
The Whalers have always been in like top 10 of everything for NHL sales. And the team hasn't been around since forever, but they still, like, my wife has a Whalers hat. Like, she just loves it. Like, anything Whalers, she'll put on. Shayna, this has been great. Let's do it again soon. Great stuff. The latest piece you can read at sportsnet.ca of disappointments around the NHL at the quarter mark and also pleasant surprises. Shayna, thanks so much for this.
Thanks for having me.
Shayna Goldman, Hey Shay, H-A-Y-Y-Y, S-H-A-Y-Y-Y on Twitter. Taking a break, Frank Saravelli is joining me in a couple of moments to around the NHL as we're getting set here, moments away from a Friday afternoon puck drop. Oh, it's so good. Between the Rangers and the Boston Bruins. Scott Oak will help us tee up Hockey Night in Canada and After Hours, and then Barry Keane, drummer for Gordon Lightfoot. A little detour away from hockey. But man, it's Gordon Lightfoot. Come on. Come on. Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome to hour two of the program. Glad to have you along today. Scott Oak coming up toward the bottom of the hour from Hockey Night in Canada. And we'll preview the Flames and the Jets, and also After Hours, and then Barry Keane drops by, drummer for Gordon Lightfoot, reopening Massey Hall in downtown Toronto last night. Meanwhile, as we return here to 590, 650, and 960, the Rangers and Boston Bruins about to get underway in some afternoon hockey. What a great time to bring in Frank Saravelli, the president of hockey content for Daily Faceoff. He joins me now. Frank, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, before we get into hockey talk, something I want to... So I've got this... One of the people who tweet us regularly is a guy by the name of Dale Hunter's Helmet. That's what he goes by on Twitter. Always great questions, comments, observations, etc. And he retweeted back to us something that you tweeted out back in September, the 24th specifically. And I'll read it back to you. Random observation only hockey people will understand. Our little man has his first game of the season tomorrow. Too little to do it himself. And I forgot how oddly satisfying it was to tape a stick. Feel free to chirp my tape job. That is, if we can start this discussion perhaps frivolously, one of the great things about being either a hockey player or a hockey parent is taping sticks. To me, I'm with you. It is one of the most satisfying things to do. What is your style? As I see, you're a full heel to toe guy.
Yeah, heel to toe, but also I definitely cover the toe as well. So that's sort of been my style. And what a timely question that is from Dale Hunter's Helmet, because today is actually a big day in this household. That same little guy that I was taping the stick for, he's playing in the first intermission of today's Flyers Canes game, the Mice on Ice at Wells Fargo Center. So yeah, I'll be on the bench, and I can't begin to explain the excitement in our house as we actually get ready to head down to the arena.
Hang on a second. That is now my kids have done that, but for Marley's games, and all they've done is stood on the line for anthems, never in the intermission. Mm-hmm. This is like one of the coolest hockey dad, hockey parent moments ever. How old's your little guy?
He's 7, and I can actually remember, it feels like yesterday, when I had the opportunity to do the same thing at a Flyers game. It was actually against the Rangers. I remember because Gretzky was playing, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going on the same ice as Wayne Gretzky was just out here a few minutes ago. And so I just, yeah, it was like unbelievable feeling. And now to get to do the same thing with my son is pretty special.
That's awesome. That's a great moment for your family. Congrats, Frank.
So as soon as we hang up, I'm actually like literally heading out to the garage to tape the stick and make sure his gear is all ready before we head down.
Make sure the gloves are dry. Make sure the tape job is all, the old standard
sharpened,
that I used.
Yep.
What's that? Yeah, skates are sharpened. And the one that I used to always get told when I first started taping up my own stick, I can't remember which coach it was, but he used to always bark into me, heel to toe gathers no snow. That's the way you do it. Heel to toe will gather no snow. So the big star of the show is going to be your son tonight, but let's jump in on Carolina and Philadelphia. Philadelphia Flyers specifically, listen, we know the injury woes, Ryan Ellis specifically, Kevin Hayes. This was supposed to be a season where they you know, Chuck Fletcher made a bunch of moves in the offseason, and they were supposed to take a significant step forward in a very tough metropolitan division. Have they taken a big enough step for you, Frank?
Not yet. It's been the inconsistency that I think has really been the problem. They've had a tough schedule, actually, to this point, and they've had some pretty enormous wins on the road. They were one of the few teams, I think they handed Edmonton their first loss. They had a big win in Washington. They beat Carolina on the road as well. That was sort of in a six-game span, and they looked actually pretty good. And one of the big things was that Carter Hart, for me, had really seemed to be back to his normal self, and he is. And actually, Martin Jones in relief on back-to-backs has actually been quite good as well this season. You know, both guys, their team save percentage, .928. For once, goaltending hasn't been an issue. It's sort of been all over the place, and it seems like or feels like a different problem that crops up every night for this team. So I think the good news for them is that they have shown the flashes that they have the ability to take the step, given those teams that they've beaten. They've sort of had their lunch handed to them in the last week here, four straight losses, twice to Tampa, once in a shootout. They went to OT last night and lost against the Panthers. So there's been some flash, but not enough. And I think the good news for them is that they're just hanging tough in what's a tough division. So certainly not out of it, but they have a lot of work to do. And I think there's just been some surprising teams in the Metro in that I think sort of everyone uniformly had New Jersey and Columbus in the 7-8 spots or close to it. And both those teams have been well ahead to this point.
First of all, I don't think anyone tries to outwork opponents more than Pittsburgh does, and maybe that's just out of necessity. Like, if the Pittsburgh Penguins are going to pick up points, they just have to outwork the opposition. But Columbus has that same work ethic about them. Mm-hmm. They just come and try to skate you into the ground. Now, it helps when you have Elvis Merzlikins as well, who's really having a nice season. But I'm with you. Like, Columbus and New Jersey are two freaks in that division, and pleasantly so, because it seems like everybody outside of the Islanders is making this point last hour, Frank. Everyone except for the Islanders, and we all know about their woes, looks like they've been given a lift. Like, Carolina's still there because Carolina's still elite no matter who you remove from it. And most recently, mm-hmm. that's Dougie Hamilton. Ovechkin looks ageless, and he's turning in one of the best seasons of his career right now, maybe the best season of his career at 36. Mm-hmm. That's a freak. And everybody else has had a lift. Like, we knew everyone else was going to get better. That's why I asked you about Philadelphia to start. Have they gotten better commensurate with the rest of the division? And the one freak, to your point, is I thought Columbus would take the step back. Quite the opposite so far.
Way back. I mean, you look again, the talent that was sort of pried out and how they went about trying to replace some of the players that they lost. I don't know that there was a ton of confidence there, but Brad Larsen, I think we should talk about him and just the job that he's done. I had him actually on our podcast with Jason Gregor, in the off season. I didn't know Brad Larsen at all. Knew of his background a little bit and his story, and it's a great one. And we hung up with our pod, and it was on Zoom, and I was like, I would skate through a wall for that guy. Like, he's honest, he's direct, attention to detail. There's no fluff. Like, it's just what he says is what he is. And I think he's right straight to the point. And I think that helps when you have a team like Columbus that's trying to figure out who they are and what they are, kind of right when you walk in the door.
You know, the interesting thing about a couple of things with Brad Larsen, one, I think a lot of the players pick up on that vibe, but two, he's a throwback and a direct line back to the Atlanta Thrashers organization. There's still only four former Thrashers in the league, two behind the bench, one Andrew Burnett and the other Brad Larsen. But the thing that's always... that I'm always impressed by, because it seems like it's always an outlier thing, is when an assistant coach becomes a head coach, their personality needs to change. And a lot of times the players look at it and say, hang on a second here. You know, last season you're the assistant coach and you're my buddy and you're inviting me and the family over for a barbecue, and now you're bag skating and scratching me. Like, it almost is like you have to assume a different personality, and teams, players can kind of look at it like, is this an act or not? And it doesn't always work. It's very seldom that it works. There have been some high-profile ones, Larry Robinson, for example, with New Jersey way back. But it doesn't always work this way. But so far, with Brad Larsen and the Blue Jackets, it has. And I just think that it's important to remark on the fact that this move, taking your assistant and making him the head coach, generally is fraught with disaster, but not so much with CBJ.
Yeah, not at all, because there is no act. It just, I think Brad Larsen kind of was who he always was as an assistant as well, that enabled him to sort of make that change and the experience that he's had too. Like, he worked his way up through the ranks. It's not like someone that was just a prodigy that, hey, we're going to give this guy a job at 32 and he's going to, suddenly take the reins and everything's going to be magical. He went through the process, went through all the steps to get to this point, so that when he did finally arrive, he was mm-hmm. actually prepared to do so.
With Frank Saravelli from Daily Faceoff, as we speak right now, the Rangers are playing the Boston Bruins. How do you see these two teams right now? For New York, I've maintained that it's the Shesterkin show. This team bleeds chances and he bails them out. And for the Boston Bruins, I think we're really starting to see, and, Krejci is gone and Rask is gone. We're starting to see, the beginning of the end of this era of the Boston Bruins. But how do you see these two squads, Frank?
Well, gone for now. And I put that in parentheses because I think there's a lot of people thinking, not just with a Tuukka Rask possibility, but also at some point, is there a possibility for David Krejci to come back? You know how early the season ends at times over in Europe. And yep. I think apparently all reports are that he's played quite well. But I kind of see this Bruins team and where they sit at the moment. The standings are a little bit deceiving. You have to go by points percentage because they've played five fewer games than a team like Toronto, who's a bit ahead of them in the standings. And so they're right in that playoff mix. Before the season started, one of my bold predictions was that the Bruins don't get in. And I took a lot of heat for that because a lot of people were saying I never even considered that a possibility. And there were a few reasons for it. One was part of that changeover that we're beginning to see. And the other part of it was just a lot of the changes that they had made on defense. Seeing Derek Forbert come in and Mike Riley get a bigger role than he had at the tail end of last season. And it's a lot to ask, I think, for some of these guys in that transition. And I think some guys that you were thinking, might really work out or find a way back to the level that they were once at, like a Jake DeBrusk, can he get back to being that 27-30 goal guy? And there's clearly a little bit of a crisis of confidence there. And so they rely so heavily on their top line that when they don't have that group going, they find a way to grind out some points and wins. Mm-hmm. But you're able to do that for the first 6 to 8 weeks of the season. But when it becomes an ask that you're repeatedly going to the well for over 82 games, I just have questions as to whether or not that can be sustainable.
Do you get the feeling that this is swan song season for Patrice Bergeron? Like, I think we've all wondered, like, how much can one body take? I mean, you go all the way back to the Randy Jones hit a million years ago, and then there's various playoffs where it's, you know, playing through ribs and punctured lungs and, like, what this guy has put his body. I mean, he's already achieved everything that you would want in hockey. Olympics on the horizon this season. Do you get the feeling that this might be it for Patrice Bergeron?
I don't, just because he's still been so productive. I think it's easier to walk away when, you know, all those things begin to add up and it takes a toll on your game. And I know that it doesn't come easy to him at his age, and the work that he puts into it is significant in order to make everything go. But 15 points in 16 games this season, it's hard to envision someone even at 36 and has accomplished so much and has pocketed $92 million to say, you know what, enough is enough. I'd imagine he's one of those guys that goes on a year-to-year type deal. I'll sign a one-year deal and let's see how I feel at the end of it. And it's pretty obvious that he's not going to be playing anywhere else. It's just a matter of how long does he continue to stay productive.
Evergreen deals, just 1 year to 1 year. Now, one of the things that we've been getting into here the last couple of weeks is, and you mentioned Tuukka Rask a couple of seconds ago, is it, I'll just put it bluntly, is it Boston or bust for Tuukka in your estimation? Like, let's say they decide to go Linus Ullmark and Jeremy Swayman and keep it that way for the season. Does Tuukka say, okay, nothing for me here, or... I mean, there will be teams that would be interested, whether it's, you know, a team like the Edmonton Oilers, who might be the best example. What do you think, Boston or bust for Tuukka?
I personally believe it's Boston or bust, just because his family's rooted there. And I think you look back on the experience that he had in the bubble when he left to go be with his family because of a family emergency, and they're not going anywhere. I don't believe that one of those players that's like, hey, you know what? I'm willing to go be without my family for 3 or 4 months. It's a really tough ask. And I think certain players, it doesn't make it right or wrong, are just wired a little bit differently and they're able to do it. I've never gotten the sense that Tuukka is one of those guys. So for me, that's how I view it. I have no doubt that teams will be calling and will attempt to try and get him there. But I think the really interesting part of the equation for the Bruins is Swayman is sort of the guy here that's helped. He's grabbed the reins a little bit. He started off a little bit wobbly. And I think when you were looking at those first 3 to 4 games, you were saying, oh man, there really might be an opening here. Can Swayman do, you know, and get back to the same level that he was at last year with the Bruins in such a limited sample size? Ullmark has sort of been all over the place. But the question with Omark is, he's clearly your guy. Like, you sign him to a 4-year deal for $20 million. How do, like, there's no way that he could be the odd man out. And so I think with Swayman, like, he still has that waiver exempt status. Like, you could send him down. Obviously, that wouldn't be the best thing for his development at this point, given the taste that he's gotten and the success that he's had. So it really puts Boston in a pickle to try and wedge Rask right back in there. And so I think that's the tough part of the equation on the Bruins end. But I think they're keeping an open mind because, you know, why not have him use your facility and try and work his way back? You don't know what your goaltending is going to look like. And more to the point with Omark, you don't know whether he's going to be healthy and on the ice. Omark has had all the talent in the world, but he developed a reputation in Buffalo, especially over the last number of years, as being someone that's, you know, a human Band-Aid at times, someone that, you know, struggles to stay healthy and stay on the ice. No one's wishing that, of course, of anyone. We'd love to see Omark stay healthy, but I think the Bruins would have to be curious exactly the situation looks like by the time Rask works his way back sometime in the next calendar year.
Couple things on Omark. One, there were times with the Buffalo Sabres where conditioning was very much a factor, sometimes showing up at training camp and really having to work to get into playing shape. And the other one is I'm still baffled, and now we're, you know, going back to the Seattle expansion draft, why Buffalo protected him. I still scratch my head at this one, Frank. I really do.
Didn't make a lot of sense at the time.
I don't get it. Like, that must have been bizarre for come free agency when they realize, he's not re-signing here. I don't know. That to me is one of the more bizarre expansion, you know, protect/leave unprotected scenarios. I still can't figure out what was happening there.
There were a few of them, to be honest. If we're gonna go back and look at the Kraken and sort of how everything has unfolded for their team to this point, like the fact that you had all this talent on the table, a Tarasenko, when you look at the season that Matt Duchesne's had, and even from the Philly perspective, taking Carson Twarinski instead of going after, like, Jake Voracek's been a point per game player and there wasn't even that much term on the deal. Like, there were options and opportunities that the Kraken didn't go after, and I think when you look back on it, I mentioned it on my show this week, the Daily Faceoff show, just this undercurrent that has existed among managers and front office executives that are kind of like snickering a little bit at the Kraken, who there's a little bit of a general feel of arrogance, that they were smarter than everyone else, that they knew better, that they built their team better than everyone else could or would. And I think there's a lot of people that are looking at their start at 6-12-1 saying, like, I guess you're not smarter than everyone else.
Well, I know that there was a lot of, I mean, the price tag for not selecting players, and this is where, you know, George McPhee and the Vegas Golden Knights really dined out as we continue to compare these two expansion teams. I mean, the price that Seattle set, like, the market just wasn't going to pay it. Like, the first and the third, so they would stay away from someone like Mark Giordano. Like, okay, Calgary wasn't going to pay that. There were a lot of teams that weren't going to pay that. And I think when we came away from the expansion draft, you know, what was one of the first things I think we all said, Frank, that is, where are all the deals? You know, now I think it might be a matter of the prices were set too high, and two, maybe general managers were more of the mind that, okay, we really got stung by Vegas. We're not going to let that happen again. Just take the player that you want, and we're not going to twist our organizations into pretzels trying to get you to stay away from people. But it was a bizarre one, and I think maybe to your previous point, I think perhaps Seattle looked at it and said, you know, there are some good players available here, but we don't want to marry ourselves to term on any contract is the only thing that I can sort of speculate. Like, that's the only thing that I can sort of point at and say, maybe that's what Ron Francis was thinking here, but whatever happened.
It makes sense, right? Because you look at the way their cap is structured now, like, they're in a fine position and an enviable position moving forward. And that's sort of the one knock or criticism of Vegas, is how quickly a team that starts with a blank slate has ended up in salary cap jail at times. And I don't blame Vegas, though, at the same time, because their team was competitive right off the hop, and they said, you know what, we're going all in on this group in terms of trying to win after getting to the final in our first year. So two totally different scenarios and situations, and I get at some point why they decided to leave that money on the table in terms of the contracts and term. But at the same time, that also meant that they left a lot of talent on the table as well.
They did. The other team that we're currently playing right now is we're watching the Boston Bruins and New York Rangers. Where are you at on the Rangers right now? Are they legitimately third place team in the Metropolitan, or they just happen to occupy that space right now?
I think they're pretty legitimate. I mean, to your point, Shesterkin has been unbelievable this year. He's already sort of worked his way into the Vezina conversation, or I think he'll be really close, particularly with the workload and the consistency. And then I think when you look at the rest of this group, though, like I raised this question the other day, is Panarin the best free agent signing of all time? Like, he has to be up there in the conversation. So Panarin's been awesome. Chara's another guy that, came to mind immediately. But Panarin is, like, rarely do you see so much money handed out and have a player that's lived up to every penny of it. Kreider has played his way into the Olympic conversation. That's something that he was probably on Team USA's long list to start, and now has, you know, sort of firmly, I think, worked his way onto the team. And what has me intrigued about the Rangers is that you look at what they've accomplished to this point, and we really haven't seen that next level from Alexis Lafreniere. We haven't seen it from Kaapo Kakko. What happens when those guys finally get to where we think they can get to? It's going to be a scary team. And it's funny in saying that, but Sammy Blais has sort of changed the complexion of that team as well. They're certainly going to miss him and a little bit of the physical edge that he provides as well. So they're still looking for a little bit of help, I think, in their forward group. And I think that they've shown at this point that they deserve and have played their way into that conversation in terms of getting the help.
I think your point about Panarin is fantastic. I think right away he joins the Rangers, and already he's on Hart ballots. I had him number one on my ballot that first year with the Rangers. I look at their left side, and you know, you think about the last time the Rangers, you know, with Henrik Lundqvist, were a really competitive team. A lot of it was because of that left side. It was, again, the aforementioned Chris Kreider. It was Carl Hagelin. It was Rick Nash. And they would, you know, defensemen would just lob pucks in front of them and create foot races. And the Rangers would win those. And that was part of their structure of how they played. And I look at this left side, and you mentioned Alexis Lafreniere, and we're still waiting for him to really pop. At times you see where the skill is. But Kreider, Panarin, Lafreniere on your left side, like, Frank, that's frightening if you're playing against the Rangers. That's an elite level left side right there.
And we just talked about the Rangers for the last two or three minutes and didn't mention Mika Zibanejad down the middle. I think the big question is what happens with Ryan Strome. Can they afford to give him the sort of deal that he's playing his way into? And I think he's going to be a big name to watch here over the next however many months until March 21st and the trade deadline. Where does that sit? But it's a quality group moving forward. And you know, we also didn't mention Adam Fox on the back end either.
Yeah, he's not bad. Hey, the defenseman of the year, who's taken the NHL by storm from pretty much the thing about Fox too is that a lot of people will point out, like, he did it his way. Like, I know it's a very unique situation. And I know a lot of people, you know, it's interesting, at the last draft, a lot of people around Calgary said, oh, do we want this Coronado kid? He's going to Harvard. And the last kid that went there, you know, ended up, you know, getting his way to the New York Rangers. And do we want to do that again? And listen, he was assured the Flames that he's going to play if/when they want. So it's not an issue. But Adam Fox, I don't know that he's a test case for players, because we have seen it before, most notably with Jimmy Vesey. But the way that he got there and the success that he's had, it's like no one's done it this way before, Frank. Nobody has dictated how he got to the NHL, where he went, and then the success followed. Adam Fox is a freak, Frank.
I love it because, I mean, it's also like, it feels like a distinctly kind of New York thing too. I'm sure there's, you know, he did it his way. It's a Sinatra song, and it's, you know, it reeks like the Rangers. I just, when you look at his talent, like he's backed it up at every point, and to see this season going in with all the expectations, you know, people are saying, how do you win the Norris in your second year? And then how do you respond to come out and be leading your team in scoring as they've taken a significant step forward in consistency and in the standings? They've gotten the bump from what I believe is the Gerard Gallant effect. He's been every bit as good as he was last year, if not better.
19 points in 19 games. This has been great. Listen, I know you got a really important hockey game to get to. Not so much the 60 minutes, but the intermission. Good luck to your little guy. Congratulations to your family. Should be a great one tonight for you guys.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Talk to you soon.
There is Frank Saravelli from Daily Faceoff, the president of hockey content for Daily Faceoff. We'll step away. Scott Oak will help us teeing up Hockey Night in Canada here in a couple of moments, and then Barry Keane, drummer for Gordon Lightfoot. Lots to get to. Stay with us. Back in a moment. Scott, how are you today, bud?
I am good, Jeff. And you?
I am doing well. We'll get the business out of the way first. Who's on After Hours tomorrow?
Our guest tomorrow night will be Matthew Tkachuk to start, and we will follow with Blake Coleman. Both have stories to tell, and we'll get the stories out of them on After Hours, because that's what we do, Jeff, on that program.
Yes, it is one of my favorites. It is it is must watch, as you well know. I've talked about this before. It's such a gem of a property, and you seem to get a lot of things out of, I mean, it's a longer form interview, so it's not just a quick little, you know, ask three questions and then off to commercial. What are you most intrigued about when it comes to Matthew Tkachuk? I mean, it's someone we know a lot about right now, but what still interests you about Tkachuk?
He's an interesting player, I guess, to put it bluntly. I like the way he plays the game. I know that he's not revered by fans in other cities, but every one of them would love to have Matthew Tkachuk on their team. I think he's prospered under Daryl Sutter, which I think a few people thought might have been a long shot when Sutter took over the team, but he's done well. The key ingredient on that team, and if they're going to make a run at the Stanley Cup, he'll be a big part of it.
He certainly will. How's the mood around Winnipeg about the Jets right now? A little bit of a speed wobble, nothing to be concerned about, or the sky is falling?
A little bit of trepidation here right now. The Jets were enjoying one of their best starts in years, Jets 2.0. Now they've gone 0-3-1 in their last four. It was a bad loss, frankly, to Pittsburgh last Monday night. They didn't have enough jam in the third period. A little bit better against Columbus, but still a loss this week. So, you know, people are, I guess, waiting to render judgment. Today's game against Minnesota in the afternoon will have a lot to do with how people feel heading into the weekend against the Calgary Flames, because that's going to be a tall order to handle the Flames. Pardon me, who are, you know, rested, 4 days rest, waiting for the Jets, who will be playing back-to-back. It'll be an interesting game.
And, you know, you mentioned the game against Minnesota. I mean, I love it when these two teams get together. And the last time we saw it in the second or maybe third week of the season, it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was fireworks. It was goals. It was overtimes. It was great performance by Andrew Kopp. Great performance by Kyle Connor. You know, I've been waiting for this Minnesota-Winnipeg thing to really, you know, take a center stage as far as being a rivalry in the NHL. And I think game one went a long ways to producing that. How much of, if any, is there a rivalry between these two cities?
I think that rivalry is certainly taking hold now, and you're correct in that the first game certainly provided a lot of evidence to that. There's no reason to expect, I don't think, a different sort of game this afternoon in Minnesota. The Jets, I would say, have more riding on it than do the Wild, given that they've gone ice cold defensively in their last four games. What, over 150 shots, and they've had no offensive finish whatsoever. But, you know, Central Division matchup, and that brings out the best in both teams, and we should expect that this afternoon.
In Winnipeg, have people stopped fretting about Pierre-Luc Dubois yet?
They have. A little bit of concern, I guess, but not just about him, about the entire offensive armory in the last, as I say, the last four games. But Dubois has won the hearts of Jets fans with the way he's played in the first five, 6 weeks of the season, for sure. Totally different player than he was a year ago. As you know, his time with the Jets started off with quarantine, then an injury. He could never get on track. Fresh start this year, and he certainly has made the most of it. He's been a gunner for them. You know, and when you think about this, Jeff, in the old days here in Winnipeg, it was if you shut down Wheeler and Scheifele, or at least limited their chances, then you had a very, very good chance of beating the Jets. But those days are gone now with players like Dubois, Connor, Kopp, Ehlers, etc. I mean, Wheeler and Scheifele are still expected to be major contributors, but
sure,
the Jets have a lot of depth. We just have not seen it prosper in the last four games.
You have a thought on Andrew Kopp, you know, expiring contract. Elliot's talked about this a lot, either on Hockey Night or elsewhere, and turning in a great season, 16 points in 19 games. You can put him anywhere in the lineup, and he excels. You have a thought on number nine?
Well, he took the one-year deal, and I think most fans love it when a player bets on himself and he wins the bet, and Kopp is in the process of doing that. Key ingredient for the Jets, the one-year deal was the best for all concerned to get him back in this year. Clearly, though, I think it's a priority for Kevin Cheveld. They have to find a way to keep Andrew Kopp. They'd be a lesser team without him.
He's an exceptional player. On the Calgary end of things, I don't know how much more we can say about this squad. I mean, they've done a remarkable job defensively. Andrew Mangiapane is finding the back of the net on a consistent basis. Johnny Gaudreau looks like, you know, the player that was on many Hart Trophy ballots three seasons ago, I think it was. Do you have a read on Calgary, and how surprised are you to find they're in their rarefied air around the tops of the division?
Well, when you think about how the Calgary Flames were viewed heading into this season, it was somewhere between they were going to be far out of the playoff picture, not a factor at all, or a lot of fans wanting a complete and total rebuild, start from scratch again, trading Gaudreau, yeah, Monahan, etc. And to see what they've done to this point, you know, is to, in effect, have proven everybody wrong. Maybe that's part of the Flames' motivation, but really it's been a redemption season to this point for everybody. And I think it starts with Jacob Markstrom, who's clearly the best goaltender the Flames have had since Mika Kiprusoff. His numbers are eye-popping, really, at 1.73 goals against. And, you know, players in front of him are playing well. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the Sutter effect. He was on the record as saying last season when he took over the team after a couple of weeks or so, he said, a lot of our players cannot play at an NHL pace. And that's obviously no longer a concern. One complete camp under Daryl Sutter, and it's his system that has been invoked there now, and the Flames are prospering by it.
Should be a good one. Winnipeg Jets and the Calgary Flames. I know you have a plane to catch. We'll absolve you of your further responsibilities on this program, Scott, but very much look forward to the game. And then after hours with Matthew Tkachuk and Blake Coleman.
Jeff, just before you go any further, had said to your producer, no questions about hockey. And I don't know what it was you're trying to prove there.
Okay, very well. Then airport etiquette. We've run out of time. That's all right. You're the best, Scott. I love you. We love you. You be well. We'll watch for you tomorrow night.
You bet. Need all the viewers we can get, and we don't care how we get them, whether it's guys waking them off the couch who cannot find the remote, which also, you know, how many times have we done that, right? Heck with it, I'll just watch whatever on there. Or you've had some beverages, you know, in the evening at a nightclub or whatever, and you come staggering in and you can't find the remote again, and you watch whatever on. So we'll take our viewers any way we can get them.
Sounds like this radio
all
property.
Right.
Oh, the knob of the dial is broken. I guess we'll listen to Merrick. Okay, fine.
Yeah. Thanks
Scott. You be well. The great Scott Oak from Hockey Night in Canada. And, of course, host of After Hours, Matthew Tkachuk on the program. That's always full value. Blake Coleman as well. So that should be a another fine edition of After Hours. Thanks to Scott, as always, for stopping by to help tee up Hockey Night in Canada tomorrow. Standing by now for someone that, listen, I've known for a long time, and he's, you know, if you've listened to 590 in Toronto for long enough, you've probably heard him on the station. Bob McCowan used to have Barry Keane on all the time. He's the drummer for Gordon Lightfoot's band. He's been with Gordon for a long time. I don't know how many years exactly, but I've seen them dozens of times together. The reopening of Massey Hall was last night in downtown Toronto, as we stand by for Barry to join here the program. Probably the perfect person to reopen what many people believe to be the perfect concert venue, whether it's music, whether it's speaking engagements. It is a gem of a hall, and I encourage anyone, if you haven't already, go see a show at Massey Hall. Reopens yesterday. Gordon Lightfoot on stage, his drummer Barry Keane, my buddy, joining us now. Barry, how are you today, sir?
Jeff, how are you, my friend?
Barry, I'm doing great. And listen, I was, you know, reading all the tweets last night, and Chris Hatfield sent a nice one out yesterday as well, and All I could think about was how magical it must have been last night. Massey Hall reopens. Gordon Lightfoot and the beautiful haunting music, which you're a very big part of, filling up Massey Hall. I can only imagine that it must have felt like it was perfect. Did it feel that way for you, Barry?
You know, the whole experience was a little surreal there, Jeff. And I mean, it was... How can you beat? You're playing at the reopening of probably the legendary venue in this country, and here I am on stage with, you know, a Canadian icon, arguably the greatest singer-songwriter this country's ever produced. So, no, the whole thing. And if I can mention, Massey Hall has been under the gun to get ready for these shows, and the staff down there, I mean, we've known these people for I don't know how many years, but if I might just say, Gary and Mike and Nancy and Kevin and Marshall and Gene, I mean, they are like a family, and they've become like a family to us, so it was great. Thanks.
Well, listen, those shows that you guys have done there over the years, I mean, and I'm not the only one, but so much of my, you know, major family experiences have been wrapped up in those shows and that music as well. I am always curious, how often do you get people pulling you aside? I mean, it must sound like, you know, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, you know, pulling the wedding guest aside and compelled to tell the story. How many people pull you aside to tell you their Gordon Lightfoot story? Like, completely, you don't even have to ask for it. They just feel compelled that they have to tell you their Gordon Lightfoot experience or what that music has meant to them.
Well, you know, it kind of runs the gamut. It runs from, hey, we played beautiful at our wedding. And then, you know, every once in a while you get Vietnam veterans who say, you know, they pull you aside and with a tear in their eyes say, Gordon Lightfoot's music got me through the war. And I mean, that is so sobering and, you know, so real, and it really is touching.
It must be. For those that don't know, tell us the story of how you became Gordon's drummer.
back in, oh my God, 1972, Gordon Lightfoot decided that he was going to do an album in Canada, and he did it at RCA Studios in Toronto, and he was doing it with his group, which was Rick Haynes and Red Shea and Terry Clements, Pee Wee Charles, but he needed a drummer, a piano player, auto harp, and banjo. So I got hired as a studio musician to play on his album, Old Dan's Records. And then a few years later, I ran into Gordon at the Juno Awards. And he said, hey, man, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm still working at the record company. And he said, I'd like you to play on the new record. And then we can talk about you maybe going on the road. Well, that album was the Summertime Dream album, and the Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald was on that album. And so I started with Gordon in 1976.
Would you have any idea? I don't even know if you keep track of these types of things. How many shows you've played with Gordon?
I can. Well, I've done, I think, 160 at Massey Hall. But no, honestly, we average anywhere from 70 to maybe 90 shows a year. And, you know, you can do the math in 46 years, maybe 2,500, 3,000 shows, maybe.
Wow. Gordon's in his 80s.
Yes, sir.
You know, Gordon's in his 80s, and some of these songs, like, you know, you mentioned, you know, The Wreck. I mean, that's a long song. You and I have talked about, I mean, I love Railroad Trilogy. Like, that's, like, the trilogy to me is... it's as perfect a song has been ever been written by anybody in this country. That's a long song,
yes,
for
sir.
Anybody to pull off. How I guess I can't shouldn't beat around. How is Gordon's stamina for a lot of these shows?
He is unbelievable. And by the way, you mentioned he's 83. He's so Canadian. We prefer to think of him as being more like 23 Celsius. So anyway, no, he is unbelievable. We did, like yesterday before the concert, we did an hour and 20 minutes on stage rehearsal, straight through, no breaks.
Hour 20?
Yeah, no breaks. And there's Gordon playing and singing and, you know, worrying about the show, what order the songs are going to be in. No, there's absolutely no worries about Gordon and his stamina. He's a soldier and a warrior, and no, he's unbelievable.
You know, being with Gordon for as long as you have, and I mean, you're a big time sports guy. I mean, you're a big hockey guy. I know you're a big baseball guy as well. Who are some of the more, listen, backstage? I mean, I've been backstage. You've introduced me to Gordon a couple of different times, and it's always special. But I would imagine you must have seen, you know, more than just the occasional athlete, other celebrity, you know, backstage to meet Gordon. Can you share some of the bigger names?
Well, you may have heard of Wayne Gretzky or Vladislav Tretiak, Gordie Howe. I mean, you know, Denny McClain from the World Series champion Detroit Tigers. I could go on and on, but yeah, you can imagine.
I'll tell you what. You know what was remarkable? I remember one of the shows that I was at Massey. Gordon, at the end of one of his songs, pauses and says, someone very special in the audience who's having a birthday, you've listened to his music for decades, can we please get a warm round of applause and maybe a happy birthday for Jimmy Buffett? And he was sitting about like three seats away from me. He's wearing this beautiful white suit, looked great, and stood up and sort of waved to the crowd. And I can't help thinking to myself, you know, Gordon's probably one of those musicians that other musicians adore. Like the musicians, like, oh, Lightfoot's in town, got to go see Gordon Lightfoot. Is that true?
Oh, I think it was my second year of being with Gordon. And to be honest, in the beginning, it was a job. I wasn't a huge Gordon Lightfoot fan. I was hired to play in the band and, you know, that kind of thing. We were hired to play a week engagement at the MGM Grand Hotel. This is 1977. Mm-hmm. And the night before we started, the hotel had thrown a party, a reception for Gord. And at the party, I was talking to Gord, and, you know, as the conversation progressed, I noticed some people were gathering around Gordon. And I looked, and it was Robert Goulet, Joan Baez, Glenn Campbell, and Roy Orbison. And
wow.
They were all looking at Gordon like he was the somebody. And I kind of, that was a moment for me where it was like, there's Roy Orbison looking at Gord like he is the somebody. And, you know, that kind of thing.
That's
And if I could tell you one other was one of my favorite memories is Kris Kristofferson drove six hours north in California to come to one of Gord's concerts. And he and his wife sat off to the side of the stage. And he must have given us 30 standing ovations as he sat and listened. And Gord was and has always been one of his heroes. So,
That is, listen, there's so many great stories like that that Gord must have. And, you know, knowing that, Barry, you're a sportsman and you're a touring musician, you must get, as we all know, a lot of downtime. I'm assuming you fill some of it by going to watch sporting events. Are there some places on various tour stops where, you know, you just have to go see a baseball game or a hockey game, or you have a favorite spot to go when you're on the road for taking in sporting events? Anything jump to mind like that for you, Barry?
Well, fortunately, we do get some time off, but as you may or may not know, a lot of our tours consist of 4 or 5 day runs where we play in 4 or 5 different cities. So we will play 4 or 5 different cities, have a travel day, and then do it again. And so there is not a whole lot of downtime. But, yeah, no, I love to get out to a hockey game. Or I went to see the Winnipeg Jets recently, went to see Tampa Bay Lightning in Tampa,
nice.
A few of those kind of things. And, and minor league baseball. I've managed to get a couple of connections in minor league baseball, and there really is nothing like seeing the San Antonio Missions or the Hartford Yard Goats. I love that kind of stuff.
They have great game ops, don't they? Like the game day operations, some of them are so creative and hilarious, Barry. Like I'm like you, I love minor league baseball just for how creative the game presentation is.
Well, and also, I mean, you find yourself, I'm standing in an aisle watching the San Antonio Missions, and I find myself talking to the mascot, Terry the Taco. He's standing, you know, this poor man in 100-degree temperature is standing there in a taco suit. And, like, you can't see that anywhere else, you know?
We're all trying to make ends meet, eh, Barry? We're all trying to make ends meet, pal.
Whatever it
takes. You, me, Terry the Taco, it doesn't matter. Listen, it sounds like it was a wonderful night last night. The run continues at Massey Hall. It's legendary. It's a staple. And if you haven't had the Gordon Lightfoot at Massey Hall experience, please go out of your way to do so. It is well worth your time. Barry, thanks so much for stopping by today. And good luck the rest of the run. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you. My pleasure, Jeff, and all the best. Huh?
There he is, Barry Keane, drummer for Gordon Lightfoot, yesterday reopening Massey Hall.